Bonjour Laurie.
Bonjour Phil.
Ça va?
Ça va bien, merci.
Ask me.
Ça va?
Comme si, comme ça. Où est l'épisode?
Phil, il est épisode 20.
20? Is that 20?
That's 20, 20! Phil. 20!
Zut
de We made it all the way to episode 20.
Bon,
listeners,
bon, bon.
Welcome very much. Bienvenue à la movie land. We apologise for the multilingual intro to that. There's not really a proper reason for it.
There's a little bit of a reason.
Well, I guess, I mean, I'm trying to, again, get the listeners to experience and enjoy my glamorous film star-esque lifestyle, because I will be on the wonderful, warm, windswept south beaches of the Île-de-France.
And I'll be at work.
Sorry. So I apologise. We were calling this on a Friday, and I'll be in France when it goes out. But hey, I'm here now.
Hooray.
What have we got in episode number 20?
A load of movies such as...
Eddie the Eagle, Britain's feel-good hit of the year, Phil.
Yes, quite. Also, we've got Huntsman, The Secret Winter War of Napoleon or something. What's it called?
The War of the Huntsman Fellowship of Winter. That's right, yeah.
No, but genuinely, what actually is it called?
It's The Huntsman Winter's War, I believe.
Also, I've gone to see Midnight Special, the new film from... John Nichols?
Something like that, yeah. A very mysterious film that's out like today, isn't it?
Yeah, I went to see it today and then I ran over here to record.
Got such a high-paced lifestyle, man.
Zip, zip, zap, zap, zoom.
And let me say again, thank you very much to Odeon Cinemas in Oxford again for supporting us for all those movies. I had a good time in mine. There's in Magdalen Street one, man. I get to sit on the balcony these days.
I was going
to
mention the balcony as well. It's great up there.
I'm not going to steal your thunder. What would you like to say?
It's just really fun out there. You nice, massive screen, great sound. Who wants more from a cinema? Not me.
Wow. You're so good. I was going to go more down the route that I was enjoying lording it over all the plebs on the
all
bottom
the poor
row.
People.
That's right, yes. Fellow, yes. If you're lucky, I may spare you a penny at the end, that kind of thing. But yeah, thanks very much, Hayden, again. We loved it. That was great. Okay, what else are we doing, Phil?
We've also got another little quirky feature. So you watch a movie you've already seen, right?
Yeah.
And it's come to that moment, a big kind of crescendo moment. And for some reason, this time, you think it's going to go differently unknown reason.
I so know it. Like, you're literally, sometimes your fingers grip the seat and you don't realise how tense you are, even though you know what's coming.
You just think, oh, maybe they're going to win this time.
Just maybe.
Come on!
It's a bizarre mystery. It's a bit of a phenomenon. I'm going to delve into that Horizon style. Okay, and then we've also got, to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the death of King William Shakespeare,
William.
Well, you know, he's just, I thought I'd just throw him an epithet there. King of literature, at the very least. The bald-headed playwright. Everyone is chatting about him this week. I mean, we don't directly talk about him, but we are having our writer friend Russ back in to talk about adaptations. A few of you have been emailing us about this, so it's an exciting feature, isn't it?
Yeah, including some adaptations of Shakespeare plays.
Well, exactly. So novels, musicals, plays, whatever, they sometimes get adapted to the big screen. What are the pitfalls and what are the big successes?
Why do it?
And you know, the Shakespeare thing also means I can shoehorn in an anecdote about how I saw Sir Ian McKellen live recently, Phil.
Oh, brilliant.
I'm sure you're excited about that.
Mr. Gandalf,
Mr. Magneto, I'm sure that's how he likes to be thought of. He had some thoughts in that talk on what it's like putting Shakespeare on the big screen, so I'll pop that in at some point.
Perfecto.
Anything more to add?
Well, we've got to say this, man, before we go. We don't normally do emails on the show, but we've got a return. It's Mr. David Samuel.
The prodigal son returns. David, how are you?
He has written in, "Hello, bros, and those who ask about me."
Wow.
A little bit grandiose.
Sure I know.
No, we love you, David. Thank you very much for emailing in, and lots of people have been asking about you. He writes, "I am sorry for my lateness. I've been on a working holiday in Peru looking into rare owl species." Just to say some knowledge.
Oh, man. Is that second the tone for the rest of the email?
On you, yeah, it's all owl puns. A baby owl is called an owlet. Baby owls sound pretty cool, so whatever name you prefer, I'll let you decide.
Wow.
Also, an owl fun fact, all owls are long-sighted and have three eyelids for various functions, blinking, sleeping, and cleaning.
So guys, if you've not come across David Samuel before, this is what you've been missing in the last few weeks. This astonishing owl knowledge.
Boom, he writes, firing on all cylinders, it's good to be back. He's written some movie quotes, which we're not going to read out now because we said we're going to save them up for another feature.
We're just going to flag this again in case you missed it in last week's episode or the one before that. So Phil and I love drawing out some random movie quotes from films that we sort of apply in daily life or just laugh at and enjoy when we remember them. And it's particularly quotes that you wouldn't necessarily think of as that memorable. So we all know the classics.
I'll be back.
Yeah, or you can't handle the truth, all that kind of stuff. We're thinking little random ones that make sense to you and only you, and it's your time to shine. Send them to us.
Little gems that you use in a completely different context. That's what I love. I love those ones.
So we're giving one more week to that, everyone to get in their quotes, and we'll do a spectacular on it next week.
He says, can I put in a suggestion for a point system?
Uh-oh.
If people say they watch something based on your recommendation, that's you or me, Laurie.
Yes.
Then they could give you points.
Ooh.
And you could have a little competition, because that's what we need.
Because the thing is, man, we have disagreed quite recently on a number of films, and that might just be the way to solve that problem.
I mean, I think this is what we've been clamouring for, some sort of gladiatorial competition.
Yeah, right. Listen, I think you can tell I'm spoiling for this fight.
Well, David Simon says it's just for fun. We know better.
No, of course not. Let's do that. Let's keep a tally. From henceforth, if you go and watch one of the films that Phil says is good, or that I say is good, and you love it as well, give us a point.
Or if you just agree with us. I think if we agree, if they agree with me, then that's a point. If they agree with you, that's a point
as
well.
And it's only when we disagree, right?
Yeah, if we're both agreeing, that's a defunct point. Who cares about that?
And I'm tempted to say we should get minuses, man. If someone goes and watches a film based on our recommendation and hates it and vehemently disagrees with us, that should be a minus. What do you say?
Bring it on. I'm not afraid.
Yeah,
you
right.
You was going down, son.
Well, the thing is, I would already be on minus one because of Chalet Girl.
And also Youth, which wasn't appreciated by your wife.
Oh, that makes me sad. Yeah, I like that idea. David, you've brought us onto something.
The gladiatorial fight has begun.
Let it commence.
I'll be back soon. Peace out, bros, or pixels if you prefer. David Samuel.
David, thanks so much. And has he attached anything?
Oh, yeah. That's a great picture.
Oh, thanks for the picture, David. Really appreciate it. Okay, well, I think that wraps it all up. Are we ready to dive in?
Yeah, let's get podcasting.
Okay, Phil, are you ready? Ready, everybody? Here we go! Off to movie land!
Think of a wonderful thought, any merry little thought.
You're not singing, Phil. Okay. See, that's enough. So that's the wrong theme tune. That's Chariots of Fire. I apologise.
Ah, it's fine, man. It's basically the same sort of movie, isn't it? It's all about sporting truths.
Living your dreams.
Exactly. It's just an eagle flying through Chariots of Fire.
Beautifully free in the wind. Maybe in that beach scene, just picture the eagle floating behind and that
its
kind of
claw
thing.
Dipping into the water.
Oh, what a beautiful sight.
So today we're going to be talking about Eddie the Eagle, the based on a true story, based on Eddie Edwards.
That's Michael in quotes Eddie Edwards there, Phil.
Okay, Eddie Edwards, the first of Great Britain's ski jumpers, a famous character, a bit of a comical character.
Correct.
And here we have a lovely British comedy film.
Oh, yeah. Weren't you eagerly anticipating this one,
eagerly.
Phil? Come on!
I thought this film was fine.
Fine. Middle of the road fine. Middle lane hogger. You know,
sort of like a camper van.
Refuses to let people overtake or undertake, that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, just sort of, look at it going.
Keeps plodding. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Phil. So we've got Taron Egerton returned in a film produced, I think, by Matthew Vaughan, isn't it?
Yep, he's the guy who made Kick-Ass.
Exactly, and also Kingsman, in fact, most recently.
And Taron Egerton is the lead in Kingsman, so you might have spotted him. He's almost unrecognisable in this film, though. Well, apart from his face being
the big
exactly 70s the same.
Aviator style glasses.
Yeah, and a sort of a weird gurn to his face.
Yeah, I've heard people say that he passes from sort of imitation and acting into a bit of a mocking jibe with his performance. Do you think that's true?
Well, I found that they almost portrayed him as a bit of a simpleton. Mm. And I felt that kind of sums up the film as a whole. It feels very simple.
It's very flat.
And
it's light.
Very fluffy. And it makes no attempts to be anything meaningful or sincere. It just sort of like, isn't this nice?
And now for the most exciting bit, here's the clip.
Mum, where's my purple rucksack?
Under the stairs.
Thank you.
Why, are you going camping?
No. Going to Germany. Coach leaving very soon. Sorry, Dad, I've got to get on them slopes.
Oh, no, not this again, no.
Excuse me.
Hang on. What am I going to tell your plastering teacher?
Tell him I've made new plans.
New plans?
What plans?
I'm going to be an Olympic ski jumper.
Oh, no.
This is some kind of joke, right?
Dad, it's not like I'm taking up ballet. It's still skiing. It's just a bit higher.
You name me one British ski jumper.
Me. Eddie Edwards.
It's a pretty good heat map of the movie, right?
Cold.
What's interesting, again, is that what I've heard other people saying is the film isn't trying to be anything more than that. And it's almost the message wants to be got across through PR and everything else that this film isn't attempting to break any records. It's not attempting to be challenging or really even interesting. It's supposed to just be a heart warmer. My problem is that if that's your target, I don't think this film even really hit that target. It kind of missed it, I thought.
Yeah, I feel like it's very overtly trying to be the British film of the year, sort of the underdog. And I feel like it was ultimately patronising. That was kind of the feeling I got. It was very paint by the numbers, very sort of, you know exactly where the film's going, point by point. I was surprised by how little characters there were actually in the movie. It just felt very low budget.
Yeah, I agree.
And I was quite sad that this is kind of the creme de la creme of British film.
I know.
Like a mainstream British film is this.
Well, there were a few weird things about this movie that I can't figure out. Number one is that my favourite person in the movie, yet again, was Hugh Jackman.
Everyone loves Hugh Jackman. Yeah, Hugh Jackman? He's Wolverine.
And he was fun to watch. He has such a simple role. It's a role we've seen a million times, right? It's the coach who's a bit grizzled and he messed up his shot and now he's going to help this young hopeful. Even Hercules, the film Hercules, has it with Philoctetes.
Oh, yeah, Phil, voiced by Danny DeVito.
Yeah, the grizzly coach. We've seen it a million times before. And Hugh Jackman does it very, very well. There's not much he does badly. And this is why it's weird, because that guy didn't even exist. He's completely fictional.
That took out all the joy.
And what was weird is that the film, the way that it's played out, as you say, with Eddie, the way that Taron Egerton plays him, or perhaps the way he was directed, you can't really relate to that guy on the screen. Because he doesn't do things in a way that anyone else ever would. He doesn't really have motivations that you'd recognise. If anything, he seems to be completely naive and foolish.
And I felt mostly sorry for his dad, who just, all of his money was getting spent on this kid, who just clearly was delusional.
But the thing, and this is where the film paints him, that's not a comment on Eddie Edwards himself, because of course...
No, he's a successful ski jumper, became world famous for a brief time.
But I just thought it's strange that, given the film is about Eddie the Eagle, actually your proxy into the film is much more Hugh Jackman than it is Eddie Edwards. I don't think you really go with Eddie, because actually he's too far removed.
He's almost a Forrest Gump sort of character.
Yeah, exactly.
And everyone else is reacting to him rather than him being the person who you're meant to be associated with.
You don't really empathise with the guy, because it's hard to understand beyond kind of, oh, people say you can't do things, now I'm going to show them that I can do things. But then that's the other strange thing I thought. That's strange thing number one, by the way. You can't think.
Yep.
Strange thing number two is that actually the story of Eddie Edwards is not that good a story. Maybe I shouldn't be saying that kind of thing. And that's partly why the film felt rather unsatisfying to me. Yeah, he was the first ski jumper, and they make it clear that it's because there were no entry requirements, really. And when he got there, he was considered to be a bit of a laughing stock in some ways, because he performed terribly, and the Olympics became a sort of personal challenge for him. It's just not that interesting a story.
Apparently, if Hugh Jackman's not real, then it's all a contrived story.
Well, exactly. And then because the event happened when it did, you know, 30 years ago, for a lot of people watching it, if you remember the event as it happened, you know that bit where he dances around in front of the camera? If you remember seeing that on TV, I bet that's quite a nice nostalgic moment. But actually, it's just slightly too far ago and just slightly under the required level of like national treasure moment that it falls flat.
I've heard of Eddie the Eagle. That's mostly because you're like, who's Eddie the Eagle?
And you watch Channel 4's The Jump, right?
No, I don't.
I do. I love that show.
Shame
He's good
you.
In it. I like him. He's charming.
Well, anyway, Eddie the Eagle, he's there, and it's sort of a name that pops up, and your parents sort of say, oh, he did this, and you're like, oh, right, okay, and then you move on.
Yeah, so that's the problem. I think, actually, the raw materials weren't really there. It had such a low bar it was trying to hit that it sets itself up to be a disappointment, and personally, I thought the music was rubbish.
Yeah, the music, I actually wrote down in my little notebook while I was watching the film, which I don't normally like to do, but I thought the music really cheapens the story. Makes
incredibly,
it feel, like
the opening montage is a disaster.
It makes it feel even more cheap and fluffy and ignore it sort of film. It doesn't feel like a film with any weight. You know, I think I've read somewhere somebody compared it to the next Billy Elliot or something like that.
No way, not even.
Not at all, just pop Billy Elliot in the DVD player. That's so much better.
Yeah.
And so much more British. And actually, it highlights why Billy Elliot works so well, because Billy Elliot isn't really about the ballet. It's much more about his family and the sort of social cultural issues that go around the area he's in. Eddie Edwards has none of that. Most of the time, he's just in a random place in Germany, jumping. That's it.
I think there are one or two moments that are quite nice, that you might not, little details about the story you might not know that pop up and that are kind of fun to see. But on the whole, it wasn't really funny enough. There weren't enough jokes where you kind of think, oh, I was really enjoying the ride and everyone in the cinema was guffawing, because there weren't any of those. And in fact, some of the jokes they did use just kept being repeated. Do you notice the bottle of milk thing?
Yeah, I didn't really get that. I didn't really care.
It was okay. I mean, I'm sure that was a feature of the guy himself. He didn't drink alcohol, he drank milk. But that came up so many times. It's like they were starved for actual jokes and content. It made me laugh. At one point, I thought, are they going to shoehorn a bottle of milk into every scene? Like, it's funny. You'll watch it. It just pops up again and again.
The good points, just so that we're not completely dumping on this movie, the only good points for me was I quite like the montage when he's training.
Yeah, okay. With Hugh Jackman.
With Hugh Jackman. And then that's kind of classic sport movie sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's always enjoyable. Also, like the Bo Derek scene, that made me laugh. It was the one time in the movie where it made me laugh.
Very strange.
And I won't say exactly what it is because we'll lose our clean.
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah.
Also, I really liked Hugh Jackman doing his comedically over the top jump.
Yeah, I enjoyed the little Norwegian skier or whoever he was. Or was he Finnish? I can't remember the guy's name.
The Finnish guy, the number one guy.
It was really odd little moment. Towards the end of the film, he gives Eddie a little pep talk. And I thought that was quite spectacularly written, actually, as a little soundbite and a little emotive moment. That was good. And it just made me wonder what happened with the rest of the film. Watch out for one of the worst cameos I've ever seen in Christopher Walken.
Yeah, I was really surprised he was in
this movie. So disappointed that he turned up. I wish they'd just put him in the photograph.
Maybe have him do a bit of a voiceover and that was
it. Yeah, that was a real disappointment because it just fell flat.
One of the quotes from the film, which I feel is quite apt, can I read it out?
Please.
This is Hugh Jackman saying this to Eddie the Eagle. He says, "Just the jump, man. Simple."
There you go. Well done, Phil. And that's the final thing, good thing I'd say, is that it did make the ski jump look pretty terrifying. They succeeded in something that has previously been very difficult. Because when you see on TV the ski jump, it's actually quite hard to get a sense of the scale.
And the heights. Yeah,
and the fear. And I've never seen that well communicated. I bring up the Channel 4's The Jump. When you watch that, actually, it's a wet blanket, The Jump, because the celebrities look like they're just doing a tiny little hop. But I'm sure, in reality, as they do it and
as they experience it,
it feels terrifying. And they did manage to communicate that several times. So, yeah, is that enough chit-chat on this one?
Yeah, just one final comment. I do think you should really pop in Billy Elliot again if you want to see something good and British-y.
Sure, yeah.
But if you don't want to do that and you want to have something lighthearted and sporty, I would recommend Wimbledon, the Paul Bettany film.
That's better. No, I agree with you there. It's not a good film.
It's not a good film, but in terms of lighthearted, feel-good British film, it's got a great cast and a good set of characters.
Dustin Dunn as well, MJ.
Nice story. It just is so much better and it feels so much more satisfying, even though it's completely made up.
Yeah.
This is a true story and you don't care.
Unfortunately so. I'm sure there'll be other people who disagree with us.
What would your grade be?
It's a C for me.
Yeah, I think C for me as well. It's nothing noteworthy.
Okay, well, I guess the Eagle's had his wings clipped before he's even taken flight. So, come on, man, give us one.
Something about Nestle and Nest and Eddie the Eagle drinking milk.
That's not a joke.
I know. I don't know how to bring it together. Help me, Laurie.
It's too late.
The Eagle's crashed and burned.
Well, I have seen The Huntsman, Winter's War, which I think stars Captain America, maybe Thor, I don't know.
Chris Hemsworth is Thor.
The Winter, isn't that Captain America's film?
Winter Soldier was Captain America's film, right. So maybe they're trying to steal some Chris Evans fans.
The Huntsman, Snow White, Winter's War of the Rings, maybe something like that.
Dawn of Justice.
Do you think, I particularly feel this because I write the titles for our podcast, and I want to try and make sure people can see which films are reviewing. When I had to write Batman versus Superman, even that was really long, but Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, what is the deal? What's up with these super long movie titles?
I think they just want to make sure that you have to read it if it's there.
But the thing is, you and I, throughout the day, as we've been discussing what we're going to cover on this episode, neither of us have been able to remember accurately the title of this film I'm about to review now.
I don't know why they just didn't call it The Huntsman.
Yeah, very, very strange. Okay, Chris Hemsworth returns as that much-loved character, the Huntsman from Snow White and The Huntsman, I think was the original one.
Yeah, the original one starred Chris Hemsworth and Kristen Stewart.
From Twilight. It was an extraordinarily bizarre movie, that one. Did you see it?
I did see that one, yeah. I found that one slightly grim, but quite engaging and interesting. Nice production values. Charlize Theron.
She was back in this one. She has a couple of scenes, yeah.
From what I remember, the first film was it felt quite glossy and dark and quite rich. It didn't feel kiddie at all.
No.
From what I've seen of this one in trailers, it looks a bit cheaper.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that about the first one. I actually quite enjoyed the first film because it was one of those things that's a bit like a beautiful mess. It's got so many weird elements and things that don't mesh with any existing genre that I kind of enjoyed the ride, especially the stars that were liberally sprinkled throughout the cast. They had Bob Hoskins and Ray Winston and Nick Frost and Kristen Stewart and Chris Hemsworth. It's huge. You are right to say this one changes. The dynamics changed. I suspect the budget has changed. I haven't looked into that. but it's quite clear. So in particular, and forgive me, I'm just going to do a mini contrast and I'll do the review properly, but you have quite lavish real sets in that first film, and it's quite big, lots of extras. In this film, you kind of only have two sets, really.
Oh, really?
You sort of have generic forest, and then you have the nice palace, which is kind of an extension. They've obviously got planning permission to add it onto a hall that appears to literally have borrowed the old sets from Rohan and some kind of Chinese kung fu film. It's one of the weirdest sets I've seen. You keep thinking Aragorn's going to turn up, but then next in line is going to be Ip Man or someone. It's really, well, really weird.
Oh, sorry, I didn't. You guys aren't done.
I'm not actually sure which film I'm in. I can't tell whether I'm in Narnia or whether I'm in Middle Earth, or, you know, it's very strange. Okay, anyway,
get out your scissors, here's the next clip.
Doesn't make any sense, Cheetah.
You will train, you will become my elite, you will become my huntsman with the mirror's dark magic. I'll rule the world.
That mirror is an evil and dangerous thing. We have to destroy it.
Together. This is what I trained you for.
So, have you got a plan?
Aye.
Is that any good?
No. Oh, this is the worst plan ever.
Did you catch those accents?
Yeah, was that Irish?
No, I think it was meant to be Scottish, Phil.
Okay.
Yeah, that was, well, less said about that, the better. What you get is Chris Hemsworth, who returns as a huntsman. Previously, he was charged with tracking down Snow White and killing her, I think, or returning her to the evil queen who wants to remain beautiful, blah, 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 blah. Everyone knows Snow White. But of course, he's ultimately charmed by Snow White, who wants to rule as the rightful queen and be a fair and just ruler. There's a big shadoo in the last film, and the huntsman survives, Snow White is put on the throne, the evil queen is defeated. This film, the huntsman is sort of just wandering around in the wilderness.
Waiting for his next mission.
Well, nomadic, and we get a slice of his previous home life, Phil.
Oh, brilliant.
Which appears to be, well, I thought they were trying to set up as a young adult franchise. He basically is part of this village who is run by Freya the Ice Queen, who is your favourite Emily Blunt.
Oh, great.
And she, I won't spoil it for the beginning because it's worth it, but for some reason or another, she decides that love is terrible and relationships are awful and can't be trusted. Therefore, she brings children to her ice palace kingdom place and trains them all to be huntsmen. So rather than a huntsman being an actual huntsman who just hunts things,
it's like a huntsman name.
Exactly,
cool.
It's the name. Yeah, exactly.
It's like the ninja fighters.
That's literally exactly what it is. Like the best fighters in the land trained from children, and she trains them not to love and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, gosh.
I know, right? I thought, whoa, it's like the Maze Runner / a Legion or whatever it all is, but kind of placed in Narnia. It's the weirdest meshing again. And Chris Hemsworth, of course, is the best amongst the kids. And of course, as well, Phil, there is a special lady. Even though they're all forbidden to love, sparks cannot help but ignite between the young Chris Hemsworth and the young Jessica Chastain.
Love is the strongest weapon.
Well, quite right, Phil. They're split apart. That is why Chris Hemsworth was on his own as the huntsman. Is it making sense? It's all quite convoluted, and that's literally within about 5 minutes of the film starting.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to work out is, why is this needed? What's the story?
So the main MacGuffin, if I can call it that, is the evil witch's mirror. And in a quite daring turn, dare I say it, dare I continue using the word dare so much, the evil mirror has not been destroyed, and in fact it seems to be turning people insane to the point where they start killing each other. That's like kind of a horror movie plot there. So they have to transport it to a safe place because it's driven the queen slightly insane. Incidentally, we don't even see Kristen Stewart's face. Snow White's one scene in this film is facing away from the camera.
Oh, right.
There's your budget, right? And then it's about how can they recover the mirror before the Ice Queen gets it, because if she gets it, she'd be unstoppable and dominate the world.
Blah, 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 blah.
Blah, 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 blah. I think you're getting the picture. It's kind of a mulchy reimagining a fairy tale squished together with epic elements and Lord of the Rings and CGI and dwarves. Nick Frost and Rob Brydon play the dwarves this time. Good comic relief.
It's just, are they actually?
Yeah, they are. They accompany Chris Hemsworth on his journey.
Did you feel engaged for the entire movie?
Personally, I enjoyed it. I mean, it's everything you expect. It's every cliche you ever imagined in your life, but they're upfront about that. You know, we were saying Eddie the Eagle, people say it's not trying to be anything else. I mean, I disagree, because I think Eddie the Eagle tries too hard to be a feel-good hit of the year. Whereas this one, the whole point about this one is it doesn't appear to be trying that.
It's, like, oh, it's a movie,
it's just
enjoy
a, it's just a movie, let's have some fun. Popcorn. And that's what works. That's why that kind of thing works. It doesn't try and exceed itself. And the key thing that makes it work is that Chris Hemsworth, he is Mr. Charming to the point where I was getting flashes of Heath Ledger.
At really?
At his most dashing, most affable, most screen capturing. I was getting that from Chris Hemsworth, right down to the rapid smile. Can you picture that? Heath Ledger in A Knight's Tale?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Chris Hemsworth does it.
Okay.
If you see that film, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
Interesting.
And the dwarves are genuinely funny. Rob Brydon makes me laugh. Nick Frost makes me laugh. They have good chemistry, those two and Chris Hemsworth together.
And are they like CGI creatures?
Well, there are some CGI creatures, but the dwarves are not, no. And there are two lady dwarves who come along. It's a very simple film. It doesn't ask anything of the audience other than to sit and enjoy and root for the good guys.
Is it less broody than the first one?
Yeah. Oh, well, I think so. There are definitely elements of seriousness to it because they have to make it a sequel, right? They've got to maintain some consistency of the land and the world. But it's quite appealing. I personally enjoyed it. And Emily Blunt is good. I know you're not a fan of Emily Blunt, but
Emily Blunt, I've started to have a bit of a reconsider. I think my initial comments, I've started to kind of rewind on that. Maybe I'll talk about that another time.
Quite right too. Yeah, she's good. And it's quite fun to notice the ways they are desperate to tell you that this is not the lady from Frozen. Like, it's quite funny. There are just little subtle things they do.
Well, because she's got ice powers.
Well, they're literally the same in so many ways. Even down to the way that they animate the ice and the clothing, they've gone almost the same, but very slightly different. It's funny.
Very slightly different.
Yeah, it's hard to explain if you watch it or not, I mean. So, yeah, personally, B-, fun film. Not much else to say, really, but watch out for Chris Hemsworth. I hope he does more and more of these kind of films where he gets to be lighthearted. Fun to watch.
Mm.
Just while we're talking about Shakespeare and his 400th anniversary or whatever it is, one of the things that Shakespeare does and is actually the driving force behind a lot of his most famous plays is mistaken identity or tiny little moments that go wrong or go a slightly different way than would be ideal, and actually the events that they inspire become terrible and tragic. You know, Othello, for example, if Othello had just talked to Desdemona, is it?
Yes. All that conviction gone.
Yeah. If he just talked to Desdemona, then the whole problem might not have happened, right?
It's those tiny little moments where, like, the flap of a butterfly's wings affects it, and then the whole movie, the whole direction of the story changes.
It's amazing what a kind of yearning and desperate feeling it produces in you as a watcher, where you just think, oh, just talk to her, man. Just talk to her. And, well, we reckon this is something that happens all the time in movies. And not only that, even if you've seen the film before,
even if you know exactly where the story goes and how it needs to happen.
Yeah, when it's done well, every time you watch it, you just think, oh, please go differently this time.
The one which, for me, I can't believe it. It gets me every time. Titanic. Every single time you see the build up to the iceberg and you see the people chatting and thinking, oh, look, there's an iceberg. I always just think, oh, maybe this time they won't hit it.
I know, right?
And it's the Titanic. Of course it's going to hit the iceberg. That's the entire point. But I just think, oh, maybe this time, maybe if only.
Just a little bit slight to starboard.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, in that movie especially, there's even that thing where you think maybe they haven't hit it because they pull it out at the moment. That's good direction by James Cameron.
Yeah.
They extract all the attention they can out of that of maybe, oh no, they're definitely sinking.
Isn't that so weird? Because, I mean, that's particularly remarkable because you don't have to have seen the film to know.
Everyone knows about the Titanic.
Yeah, right. Do you know the one that gets me every time is Gladiator?
Oh, yeah. Which one?
Well, I'm talking about the one, the final one. Can we give it away? We don't need to worry about spoilers for Gladiator, do we?
No,
I'm going for it. So I'm talking about the plan that they have to break Russell Crowe. What's his name? Maximus?
Calculus? Decimus Meridius.
Yeah, that guy. Willius, the Roman chap.
Willius Bilius.
Maximus Willius Bilius. That wouldn't have been such a good name, would it? They break him out of the jail cell and they've got this plan to meet his servant, Quintus, or whatever his name is, and ride away with him.
Start a revolution, basically.
Exactly, form an army. And every time I watch it, I think, oh, it's going to work out differently this time. Nope. He says, sorry, gets shot by an arrow and gets hung on a tree. Horrible.
I was thinking later on in the movie when he's fighting the guy. I always think maybe this time he'll survive.
Oh, he's not going to bleed.
He's not going to die and in the last moments be like walking into a field and... that
music.
Bit, yeah, exactly. I always think maybe this time he's just going to make it.
Isn't that weird? So what do we put that down to?
I mean, like, maybe it's like what you said. It's just the longing. It's a good storytelling. You're invested in the character. You're invested in the stakes. And you just think maybe this time it'll be different.
Your mind probably isn't preoccupied with the plot. You're not particularly looking to see what's coming next. You're more there with them in the moment.
If you can communicate something that is achievable, that they could survive, it's achievable that they could avoid the iceberg. It's achievable that the plan could work and they wouldn't get caught out.
Is this kind of tied together with another feature that I'd like us to do, which is foreshadowing in movies and the little tricks that directors and screenwriters have to kind of hint at something that's coming? And often you think you're really clever because you guess what's going to happen. Mm. But actually, probably what's happened is
want you to guess.
Exactly. You've fallen for the screenwriter's trick. You've noticed that thing and you think, oh no. And it builds the sense of dread in you. And perhaps it's deliberately using or abusing that particular trope in films that signifies to you, oh, it's going to be okay this time. Maybe there's a kind of reverse. Do you know what I mean?
Or you think there's enough room for them to slip through that door that's closing or whatever.
Yeah.
It happens even in like rom-coms, man. Have you ever seen the film Serendipity?
I love that film. I went to the place in New York.
Did you?
Yeah.
So John Cusack and Kate Beckinsale.
That's right.
You love Kate Beckinsale.
I mean, come on, man. I'm married now. I've only got eyes for one woman and that's the truth. But Kate Beckinsale at the time, yeah.
15-year-old you or whatever.
Yeah, she was. I think I had a dream once where I met her in a library. It went really well.
Oh, good. She fancied you then.
Of course. Yeah.
Your super charming self. Anyway, in that movie, there's that moment in the beginning where they stupidly, Kate Beckinsale's character decides to leave it up to fate whether or not
they
get together.
She's really into the fate thing, yeah.
Oh, irritating. And anyway, they try and go, they have this weird plan to jump into these different elevators, go up and they'll hit a number. And if they happen to arrive at the same floor, then it's fate and they're meant to be together. And what's really irritating is they get in and they both hit the same number.
Yeah.
And then the stupid little kid
comes
in.
The kid dressed up like a devil, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's hissing
away. And then he hits all the numbers and it's just like,
Your two-star-crossed lovers, Phil, maybe they'll never meet.
It's unbearable. And the thing which is really irritating is that you know exactly what the film is doing. Of course they're not going to meet, because if they met, that's the end of the movie. And it's like 20 minutes in or 10 minutes in even.
Yeah.
But at the same time, something in it.
What's interesting is you said it's so annoying that Kate Beckinsale's really into fate. That's all part of it, man. They want you to feel frustrated at why are you doing this? Why are you toying with all this great opportunity that's right before us? Incidentally, which she's already going out with someone at the time, so it isn't that great.
They both are.
I know, it's another one of those movie things where you just kind of like, yeah, wouldn't it be great? No, it wouldn't be great. But anyway,
that's
like,
another thing in rom-coms,
man. Yeah, well, we've done that. But I think part of your frustration is all part of the tricks they're playing. There's a lot more in common with good filmmaking with like magic, I think, than anything else. And that kind of stage performance, misdirection, misleading you as a viewer.
I mean, sometimes it's hard to sneak things by. I've often thought that. But this is a different sort of technique, isn't it? It's pulling you along, making sure you're joining the dots.
I think.
So that you really want to finish off the picture and at the last moment they take it away.
Yeah, well, listeners, again, that's only a little one, really. I mean, I don't have anything more to add, do you, Phil?
No, I just wonder if there's any other ones.
Films that you just love to watch. I think most commonly this is with bittersweet movies where you dread the thing that's coming. But I think also, as you say, there's serendipity where it's just kind of more frustration than anything else. Like, why throw away this opportunity?
Yeah, oh, that Kate Beckinsale.
Bridge to Terabithia is another one, man. Oh, have you seen that?
You've talked about it before, haven't you?
What a film.
Emotional sucker punch.
Absolutely destroyed me. But anyway, yeah, on that note, let's move on.
I rushed to see Midnight Special. It came out today. We're recording today. I've gone to see it, not at midnight, but Midnight Special. The new film from Jeff Nichols, not John Nichols, as I said earlier. Sorry.
That's perfectly allowed, Phil.
I'm a human being.
Don't we know it? Yeah.
Here's the little blurb, the plot summary for anyone who's interested.
Yeah, because, man, I've seen the trailers for it and there's some kind of weird sci-fi thing going on. I have no idea what this film was about. Please enlighten me.
Well, I'll try my best. This is what I'll say. A father and a son go on the run after the dad learns that his kid has special powers.
Wow. Sounds good.
Ooh, my hair is in my eyes. I think I need a clip.
Why are you wearing those goggles, huh?
Stop! Stop! He's with me. He's my son.
Yeah, well, you ought to watch your kid.
Yeah, I got it. Thank you.
Doing it okay? You cannot leave the band. You hear me?
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I shouldn't have left you.
No. I'm sorry.
There you go. Pretty dark and broody, isn't it?
It was so mysterious. I've got no idea what's going on. And I even saw the video that went along with that audio.
So it's really intriguing. It's a good sort of mystery environment, a good sort of atmosphere. You really are hooked right from the beginning. There's a really nice opening, which is kind of shrouded in darkness and mystery. And then the title sort of suddenly pops up, Midnight Special. And you're
okay.
Like, wow, what's going good on title. Here? Well, I wonder what that means. Having watched the film, it feels frustrating. It is a frustrating film. It promises so much in the first 45 minutes and it delivers something. But I think most people who are going along with what the film is giving you in the first push, I think they'll be disappointed. The film is constantly asking you to say why. Why is that happening? Why are they after this person? Why are they doing that? Why can't he be in the light? What's going on? Why is his eyes glowing? Why? And then when you get to the point...
Sorry.
Why?
Yeah, I love that song. I enjoy that. It's so good.
But when you actually get to kind of the midpoint, there's a scene where they finally kind of give you some sort of explanation. And it's the most brief explanation of what's going on ever.
Is that a good thing or unsatisfying or what?
Well, so it made me laugh. Basically, a character gives an explanation to Kirsten Dunst and she says, I understand. And then immediately after, it cuts to Joel Edgerton and he just looks completely dumbfounded. He's just like, what? He's the guy I was with most of the film because he has no idea what's going on. He's just sort of like there for the ride.
That's cool.
And I quite enjoyed his performance, actually. Across the board, there's some really good performances. The film is shot beautifully. It's directed well. But the story is not up to scratch. That's my big takeaway from this.
Right.
It's written and directed by the same person, Jeff Nichols, and he said he wrote this in response to becoming a father. If you've seen other sci-fi films, there won't be much here to surprise you, I don't think. It's about the journey, the experience of sort of being intrigued, I think. I think that's what the film offers you.
That sounds to me like the Super 8, lot of what made that fun, right?
Some people have compared this to Steven Spielberg, and right. Super 8 was kind of a Steven Spielberg.
With J.J. Abrams mimicking, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And there is a kind of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
Similar. I think that's a better film and more satisfying. This film, there's real quality in Michael Shannon, the father's performance. There's good performance from the little kid as well. I don't know the name of him. Kirsten Dunst did a good job, but she is kind of unnecessary.
Oh, that's a shame.
There needs to be almost a second draft for this film where they streamlined it. Some of the crucial moments, you feel like the wrong character is there.
That's a really odd thing to say. As in, you, in your head, you're writing it differently. You're thinking,
yeah,
I can imagine how they would react and that would make way more sense.
Yeah, like totally. Why? It seems like the two biggest people that you want in a scene, a very climactic scene, you'd want them there, but they don't put those two people together.
That is strange. I wonder why.
You've also got Adam Driver, who's Kylo Ren in the new Star Wars film.
Yeah, I like him.
He's in this. He plays sort of a scientist, investigator of what's going on. There's a very bizarre subplot about kind of a religious cult.
Okay.
But lots of the things that are introduced, you know, when I was saying earlier about those why questions, lots of the things that were introduced, they just kind of vanish.
I mean, sometimes they do that because they want to set up sequels, right? But you don't think that's what's happening?
I mean, maybe there's going to be a sequel. There potentially could be a sequel narratively, but I don't really think... It seems like quite a small movie. It seems like a small personal movie that this guy's done. This guy, as I said before, did Mud, which was a really interesting film. It stars Matthew McConaughey, and it's about sort of these kids who define this sort of criminal.
Right.
And that was a really interesting film. I'd really recommend seeing Mud. This one, I think maybe give it a miss.
Okay, interesting. You know, I have to admit, my main question for this one, beyond thinking what on earth is this about, is that whenever I've seen the TV trailers that are on, they're very quick teaser trailers, so quick, you can't really see anyone's face who's in the film. And every time I've seen it, it looks like an artificially aged Benedict Cumberbatch.
That's Michael Shannon.
The cuts are so fast. Does he look like an artificially aged Benedict Cumberbatch?
No, he looks like General Zod because that's the same guy.
Well, I wonder why I thought that. I wonder if anyone else thought that. All right, well, they've answered all my questions.
Have I actually answered all of them?
Well, I did, like you say, I don't know. I heard almost nothing about the film except seeing the trailers. You haven't been able to shed that much light on it because it sounds like you don't want to spoil it too much. And even when, if you did, the film would still be confusing. So, yeah, I don't think there's that much more to ask. Was the music any good?
Yeah, all of the production values, all of the acting, the directing, the cinematography, all fantastic. It's the actual story. And is it a proverb which says, like, a fool seems wise before it speaks?
That's right, yeah. Keep silent, everyone think you're the man, which is, you know, obviously why that's not something you can ascribe to us, Phil.
Mm. In movie land, I think it's more like if a movie is mumbly, it seems meaningful.
Good call, man. People accuse Tom Hardy of this wrongly, I think.
Yeah, Tom Hardy, I could see... But this film, I found some of the dialogue, I had no idea what they said.
Right.
But I just looked at Joel Edgerton and he just looked confused, so I was like, I'll stick with him.
I like that. That's a clever idea for a character. Put someone in there who reacts reacts as you should react.
Like audience surrogate. I almost suggest if you do go watch this film, just watch it with him as your buddy.
What would your grade be then?
For me, it is a C. Very frustratingly, if it was just based on film technical skills and all that sort of jazz, I'd give it much higher. But the narrative is so thin.
Mm.
It's like A4 paper thin.
It's a shame. I feel like all three films we've seen this week, we enjoy watching them as I did very much. They're not, you know, it's a bit of a thin week for movies, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I thought it was a real shame because Midnight Special has been given quite good reviews by some people.
For sure, Eddie the Eagle has as well.
But I just think, I don't get it. From an audience perspective, I don't get it.
Well, listeners, what did you go and see over the Easter holidays? Did you enjoy any of those? Have you seen Midnight Special? I mean, we're saying that it's out today and it's like, whoa, hot off the press, but that's because we're recording this on a Friday night, I'm afraid. So like,
because somebody's going to France.
I do apologise for that. But if you've seen any of those, let us know your thoughts. SuperBaileyBros@gmail.com or @SuperBaileyBros. And as we introed with David Samuel, if you agree with me or you agree with Phil, then hit us up with a point. And if you don't agree with us, then I guess you can send us a minus point as well. That makes me nervous.
That does make me really nervous.
Let's try it, man.
If I'm in the negatives, what happened? Can we start with like plus 10?
Well, no, but then the thing is, it's only a competition between you and me. So if you're on minus 10 and I'm on minus 12, then you still win. Congrats.
No, but let's start positive. I don't want listeners to think we don't know what we're talking about.
No, I like the idea of minuses. I think that's fun. Okay, all right, let's move on.
So talking about adaptations.
And to be clear, just in case people think, this is when you've got a book or a novel or a play or whatever, and you turn it into a film.
Or a Disney park ride.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, very good.
Well, that's the thing. You can adapt so many things, but I guess the normal thing is that you would adapt a novel or a graphic novel or something along those lines, especially something which has been a big hit.
And there's probably actually more examples of that in recent times than maybe the filmmakers would care to admit. Like The Martian is an adaptation of a novel.
The Big Short was an adaptation of another book.
So was Room. The other nominated picture, all the Oscar nominees adapted from books. I hope not.
Apart from, well, actually, Quentin Tarantino didn't get the nomination for Best Picture, did he?
Quite rightly so. And obviously, there are very famous ones like Mary Poppins. There was a whole film about the making of that adaptation called Saving Mr. Banks. So it's a very, very well understood thing in Hollywood.
And you can understand it. If you've had a book that's done incredibly well, you know, for one thing, there's an audience out there who will like it. Often there's a loyal fan base. You know that they're going to go and see it. So from a commercial point of view, it makes sense because you're going to get a certain amount of success no matter how well you adapt it.
And is it fair to say also you've already got proven material?
Yeah, I think you do, because you've got something that works. Whether or not it work on film is another matter, but you've got a story that works. Alfred Hitchcock was really good at this, if I can bring in...
Yeah, go ahead.
Alfred Hitchcock. He adapted a lot of books, short stories, to make his films, and often he wasn't very faithful to them. So he would get the central idea, and then he would make it into an Alfred Hitchcock film. So you've got Rear Window, based on a Cornell Woolridge story.
And this is the guy who's in a wheelchair and observes things through a window across the street, right?
Exactly. So he's broken his leg, I think that's right. And all he's got to do, he can't leave his flat, all he's got to do is watch his neighbours and observe their lives. And then he becomes convinced that somebody who lives across the way from him has murdered his wife. And so that's the central idea. And Hitchcock takes that and says, you know, it's a brilliant idea, so I'm just going to write my story. But Hitchcock does it again and again, because you've got the birds from the Daphne du Maurier story. The Daphne du Maurier story is set in Cornwall, like the rest of a lot of her books. And it's a very, very bleak story. So you don't get the romantic subplot. You don't get any kind of hope at the end. But he takes a central idea, which is the birds are attacking people and we don't know why it's happening, but it is happening and it's scary, and makes it into an Alfred Hitchcock film.
That is an amazing film as well. Yeah. And to this day, what a great watch.
And it works. And he does it again and again. He did the same for Psycho from the Robert Bloch story. Famously, The 39 Steps by John Buchan. He takes the idea of a man on the run from the police and from a mysterious criminal organisation, and he basically scraps almost everything else except for the setting, which is Scotland, and to such an extent that you wouldn't necessarily recognise the story unless it had the same title.
Is that Richard Hannay?
Yeah, Richard
Hannay. Oh, I love that guy. What a classic character. See, this is really interesting to me, because today when people do an adaptation, it tends to be something like The Hunger Games or The Maze Runner or whatever it is, which has already got a really captive audience. And then Harry Potter as well, obviously, is adapted from books. And what is constantly levelled at those films is complaints by fans of the books that the movies have moved away
I think you've complained as well, Laura, haven't you?
Precisely so, Phil. the moved away, and they've sort of eliminated elements of the story that would have been brilliant to see in the film, but they've sort of they've added stuff in, removed bits to make it all Hollywoody and a bit flimsy. But actually, I can't imagine that same criticism has ever been levelled at Alfred Hitchcock.
I don't know. Maybe the guys who wrote the original things criticised him when they turned up to the cinema and was like, "Hey, guys, come and see the film that I helped to write." And then it's something they don't even recognise.
Two obviously very different approaches, but yeah. Do you have one that you think works better?
I don't know. I don't have a particularly strong opinion on it because, you know, sometimes it just works and other times it doesn't. I like the idea of being faithful to the book, or at least capturing the spirit of it, if not slavishly.
The elusive capturing the spirit of the book. I know. The essence of the book. What does that mean?
That's hard, yeah.
But yeah, I think if you're too slavish, you can sometimes... It can just be dull.
I think that was definitely true for Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. That was almost every single scene from the book is in it, and it was dreadful.
Yeah, well, I mean, I still enjoy that film.
I've chosen three of my favourite adaptations. I don't know why I've chosen three. It's just an arbitrary number. But isn't that what you do on these things? You're like, here's my top three.
We like lists, yeah.
Okay. That's top three with Russell Thompson.
It was working on BuzzFeed. It can work for us.
Do you know what? And they're ones that I just like, and I will defend to a certain extent, but, you know, it's not meant to be definitive.
Okay.
No, we want it to be definitive.
Did you think people might think that it was?
No, I'm sorry. If you wanted definitive, I think you should have invited somebody else on. Okay, I'm going to go, first of all, for The Quiet American. Michael Caine, Brendan Fraser. It's adapted from the novel by Graham Greene, the 1955 novel set in Vietnam. It's about Michael Caine's character, Thomas Fowler, a journalist in Vietnam in the 1950s. And Alden Pyle, how about that for a name?
Yeah, so, is that actually his name?
Yeah, I have, unless I misread it, which would be embarrassing.
referred to as Pyle throughout the book.
He really is Pyle, yeah. He is the quiet American of the title. And he's this idealistic and quite naive young man who is working, we think, for the CIA. He's in Vietnam to basically spread an idea of liberal democracy as opposed to French colonialism and communism. He's there representing the American government.
Wow, that's pretty serious.
Yeah, so he's an idealist. And then you have Michael Caine's character, who is a complete cynic and who is quite a lot older than him. So the big backdrop is political intrigue. And then in the foreground, you've got Michael Caine. And in fact, let's say Thomas Fowler, because then we can say Alden Pyle. So you've got Thomas Fowler and Alden Pyle, who are in love with the same woman.
Okay.
And Michael Caine versus Brendan Fraser.
I know, yeah.
That's an interesting bout.
Yeah, head to head.
And the woman's name is Fuong. And in fact, you know what? At the beginning of the book, he says, "I'd like to thank Fuong, who is a genuine person." And borrowed her name, yeah.
Is it fair to say you're a big fan of the book itself?
Yeah, I was a big fan of the book. And when the film came out, I wanted to see it, but I wasn't expecting it to be so good. And it really is good. It captures the book and it's a very faithful adaptation.
So in other words, it didn't do the Hitchcock thing of taking the idea and running with it.
No, exactly. It captures the narrative of the book, captures the spirit of the book. Can I say that?
Elusive? Yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah, it's okay.
And it gets it right and it gets the characters right. Can I add an element of discomfort into the conversation?
Okay.
Is that allowed? I've not mentioned this, but I think I lent my copy of the book to Phil about 2 years ago.
Oh,
I thought I gave it back to you. Have I not given it back to you?
I don't think so.
I know exactly where it is then, if I haven't given it back to you.
Look, I tell you what, let's leave it there. It could be a cliffhanger. And then on the next podcast, you can tell them where we can work out where we found it.
Listen, so I'm going to leave you to imagine this scene.
Do you know The Quiet American is about two men after the same woman? This is like two men after the same book.
Well, okay, so this is one that you love because it's faithful and somehow, even within 2 hours or whatever it is, manages to communicate everything the book does.
Yeah, and it really works and gets the themes across well. So I would put that on as one of my favourites.
Recommended.
Yeah, and now I'm gonna say another one, which is better known, and I'd be interested to know what you guys think. I also think The Shawshank Redemption is a really good adaptation.
That's a funny one, though, because it's based on a short story by, what's his name, Stephen?
Stephen King, yeah.
Stephen King, and the book itself is very brief, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very short. It's called Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption. It's a novella. It's part of a group of stories he published called Four Seasons, which has also got Stand By Me.
Oh, you know the film Stand By Me? Yeah, I do.
That's based on another Stephen King story, which is in the same collection.
Oh, so good adaptions twice there.
Yeah. And one of the things Stephen King did was he sold the rights to some of these stories really cheaply. And he sold this one for, I read somewhere it was $5,000 to Frank Darabont, who did an amazing job of it. And I really like it because I just think The Shawshank Redemption is a really good film. I don't think it works. And you know, it's at the top of all those polls that you
get
of favourite films.
You can't not be moved by it, I think.
No, it works despite the fact that it's not really a very faithful adaptation of the book.
Well, just to point out one of the biggest changes in the movie, Red, an Irishman, is played by Morgan Freeman.
And there's even a line in the film which they decided to keep in, where Red says something like, it must be because I'm Irish or something like that. And the film didn't do well at all when it came out. It didn't do well commercially. It wasn't critically well received.
It was a word of mouth sort of, it was thanks to the VHS that it became a big hit. It was one of the most rented movies of all time, I think. People sort of mentioned it to their friends and then
it's not exactly a cult classic because it's well known.
It was so well regarded now that I think it's gone from cult to mainstream.
And I think it works. And we don't have to talk too long about Shawshank Redemption because everyone's seen it. And if you haven't seen it, then...
Do you hear that, listeners? If you haven't seen it, you're nobody. According to Russell J. Thompson.
Thing is, I'll second that. You need to see that movie pronto, basically.
Personally, I find it too rich a meal. I couldn't have more than one of those a year.
I'm going to say a third film now, which is what I think is one of the best adaptations.
Rounding out the top three with...
This is a bit offbeat, so I'll be interested to know what you think. I think one of the best adaptations is The Muppet Christmas Carol from 1992.
Okay, I mean, I like it. It was fun. It was a fun way to read Dickens, but...
Do you want me to justify?
Yeah, I'd be interested.
Please do.
So I remember seeing that when I was small, and I had it on VHS, and I'd watch it a lot. And, you know, I loved the songs and it was fun and there was the Muppets and, you know, Gonzo played Charles Dickens.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I was a bit older, I read the book. And as I was reading the book, I just kept thinking, well, this is the Muppet Christmas Carol. And for some reason, I thought the Muppet Christmas Carol would have deviated so much from the book that I wouldn't have recognised it. But it's such a faithful adaptation that whole chunks of dialogue from the Muppet Christmas Carol are in the book.
No,
and
really?
And are just taken directly from the book.
Well, just placed in different characters' mouths or what?
Well, not necessarily. So there's the line, Scrooge says to Marley's ghost.
And Michael Caine as well.
Yeah.
Okay, I can go, yeah.
I'm sensing a trend here.
Yeah, interesting. Sorry, what does he say?
Scrooge says to Marley's ghost, there's more of gravy than of grave to you, because he thinks he's got indigestion and that he's hallucinating.
Yeah, okay.
And that line's in it, and loads of other lines are in it. And so that surprised me when I came to read the book. I just thought, well, actually, The Muppet Christmas Carol is a genuinely faithful-ish adaptation of A Christmas Carol.
So basically what they've done is just put in Muppet characters in roles and played it kind of straight. Is that fair?
Yeah. And you have Marley and Marley instead of just Marley.
Yeah, that's quite fair. Yeah, they're brilliant in it as well. That used to scare me. We used to have a trailer for that on one of our other Disney DVDs when his mouth opens up. Do you remember that? As the door knocker. Yeah, it used to terrify me, genuinely. That's a really interesting one, because if Russ is to be believed, then that's quite a remarkable one, because they managed to make a story that is quite adult in terms into a quite lovable, laughable children's tale that still has a lot of pathos and even dialogue from the original novel. That's amazing.
Yeah, and the thing about Michael Caine, and I'm sorry to talk so much about Michael Caine, it really wasn't my intention until I looked at what I'd written. I was like, it's quite Michael Caine heavy. But the thing about Michael Caine is that he plays it completely straight. He's not playing like a slightly comedy Scrooge, and he's not even acting as though he's acting opposite Muppets. If you just watched his performance, you'd think he was just in a proper straight adaptation of A Christmas Carol.
He's just a top quality actor, right? He's just,
well, you know, you get what you pay for, don't you? You know, there is the TV series Dickensian on the BBC.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan as well. And I quite like Dickens. And I was basically showing off a bit. I was saying where all the characters were from, because I was familiar with some of the Dickens books. So I say, oh yeah, this character's from this book, this character from this book, and I knew all their names and I thought I was really clever. And my wife was saying, who's this character? And there's me thinking I'm really clever. And because you've got Marley and you've got Bob Cratchit, I said, oh yeah, that character is called Bob Marley. And you know what? I didn't realize I made a stupid mistake, but there was something as I said it, I was thinking, it doesn't quite sound right.
Bob Marley in A Christmas Carol. What a film that would be. I could just imagine a supercilious air that was yes, that's Bob Marley.
Do you know what? It's a great idea for a film, isn't it?
Well, I've been having to think myself about these sort of things as well, these sort of films as well. And I was thinking about something that a very famous one that Emma Thompson did, which was Sense and Sensibility. She wrote the screenplay for that film and starred in that film.
She actually wrote it. I didn't know that.
Yeah, she won an Oscar for it as well.
Amazing.
And what she did, she was well regarded because basically she took literal passages of that book and put it in the film. Do you think that's the secret to a good film version of a book?
Using actual text from the novel.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I think you get a flavour of the novel, but then I suppose it's dangerous as well, isn't it? Because, you know, if by thinking just you can put blocks of stuff in a film and that's going to be fine and it's going to be a good adaptation. It isn't necessarily. I went to a talk by Ronald Harwood. You know Ronald Harwood? He's a playwright and a screenwriter, and he wrote, he adapted The Pianist.
Oh, cool.
He won an Oscar for that. He adapted The Diving Bell and The Butterfly and has written all sorts of things. And there was like a question and answer session at the end. And I asked him, how do you adapt a stage play to the screen? And what's the worst way of doing it? And he said the worst way of doing it is just to get chunks of dialogue and just transfer it into a screenplay. And he said that was the worst thing. And he said he looks for pictures, certainly in a stage play, and then uses those pictures as ways of exploring the screen and as of ways of writing a screenplay. When I asked him the question, I was the first person to ask a question, and they brought a microphone over. But when I started my question, like, I just put the microphone to my lips and I said, Mr. Harwood, what? And I started my thing, and it was so loud, it was so painful. And you know, Ronald Harwood
is booming around the room,
and I could see a pained look on his face.
He winced.
he really did, because it was painfully loud.
That's quite a good claim to fame.
I felt terrible.
That's such a classic for those conferences.
I know. Oh. And the lesson is, don't be the first person to ask a question. And you know what?
What? Because of mic sensitivity.
Because, and there was another.
You may deafen the host. Yeah. One thing that I always find really fascinating is watching an adaptation of a Shakespeare play, because if you found that there are some writers who are so venerated that the very idea of touching the dialogue of Shakespeare, people just stay away from it, and they relentlessly just put Shakespeare plays with Hollywood actors on the screen as if that does the job. Have you noticed this? Do you think they work?
Oh, I don't know, because I love some Shakespeare plays, but sometimes when I see something as Shakespeare, I just I sigh a bit, and I shouldn't, because I love, you know, I'm a lover of literature, and I love, you know, the plays that I'm familiar with of Shakespeare's, I really like. But when I come across one that I'm not so familiar with, I'm like, oh, I don't want to.
You know,
I don't want to have to sit.
What bugs me about it is sometimes the way it's presented, because of that very thing. It's Shakespeare. It's almost like you're not really watching an adaptation or a movie. You're watching like a tribute. Do you know what I mean?
I know. Yeah, I do know what you mean.
Guys, I got the perfect thing for you guys then. 10 Things I Hate About You.
Okay. That's Taming of the Shrew.
Taming of the Shrew, retelling with Heath Ledger and Julia Stiles and what's his name? Joseph Gordon-Levitt, a very young Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And that was an adaptation of Shakespeare there.
That was actually, and that is a really, really good one. And that's what I'm saying. I think they did it right. And they didn't do the foolish thing of calling it The Taming of the Shrew in a sort of 90s reimagining of that. I don't know.
The Taming of the Rat.
You know what I'm saying? Instead, they called it something completely different.
What would it have been
I'm trying to think. It would have been
The Taming of the Cassette Player. The Taming of the Walkman. I can just go do a list of 90s references if you like. The Taming of the Backstreet Boys.
But that is definitely the way to do it, because they just alluded to it. And actually, it enables people like yourself, by the sound of things, Russ, to say, do you know what this is actually based on? This is actually based on a Shakespeare play. Because it's not...
I really hope I'm not that guy.
I am that guy.
Well, actually, you know, people who can't let it go.
I think that's all of us right now.
But that's the way to do it, because you just... It's there if you want to spot it, but it's not in your face.
Fine.
I wonder, again, listeners, you know, what have you seen? There's different ways to do adaptations, and either they work or they don't work, as I think basically what we're saying, regardless of the approach. It's all to do with the people involved in the movie and how good they are at doing movies, regardless of the novel. Do you think so?
I think, yeah, you can never predict whether something's going to work or not. And something which they say is not possible to adapt, maybe it is. You know, you might say Ulysses by James Joyce is impossible to adapt. Well,
why anyone wants it?
Well, maybe it is, but maybe somebody can find a way of doing it. And
sometimes when you hear people talking about you, there's no way you could ever adapt that. I sometimes think the authors are just being a bit pretentious about their own works. So I remember Alan Moore talking about Watchmen, that graphic novel film, which then was made into a film by Zack Snyder. He said it was unfilmable, and then Zack Snyder filmed it. So I don't know what he was talking about.
People love that kind of thing. They said that about Cloud Atlas as well. Sometimes it's practical, because obviously you need pretty serious effects to do that book. Yeah, maybe it's just pretentious sometimes.
They're limiting the creative potential of filmmakers, I think. That's the thing. Just because they can't do it doesn't mean somebody else can't.
There's one more thing to bring up, which is novels which will never be adapted, not because they're unfilmable, but because the author doesn't want them to be adapted.
Can they veto it?
If you don't want to sell the rights, not that I'm an expert on contracts.
I'm sure you've been approached lots of times, Russ.
Russ, the lawyer as well.
Always said no so far.
But yeah, you don't have to sell the rights. If you want the money, you can. But some people don't want to. And famously, J.D. Salinger, who wrote The Catcher in the Rye, didn't want it to be filmed. So that was a big hit in whatever it was, 1945, 1946, when it came out. And it sold millions of copies.
Well, it's still huge. Like, that was on school prospectuses for years.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a really popular book, and it's quite iconic. There won't be a film of it because Salinger didn't want a film of it. And so that was
I'm amazed
his
he can
decision.
Do the lifetime rights to that. I wouldn't be surprised if someone does it.
Well, yeah, eventually they will because of copyright laws. It will expire, but that's going to be decades. The other one is The Shadow of the Wind, Carlos Ruiz Zafón.
Yes, I'm sure I've read that one, Phil. Have you?
No, I've never heard of it.
That was a very popular book. It was a big bestseller, and it was in Richard and Judy's book club.
That is, I mean, if you're looking for a seal of quality, that surely is it.
Do you know what? When I said the name of that book, and you guys didn't recognise it, you looked at me as though I was some sort of intellectual. And then when I said it's in Richard and Judy's book club, you looked at me like I was something on your shoe. But again, Carlos Ruiz Zafón, he doesn't want that to be adapted because he doesn't trust them with it, I suppose.
As a writer of both novels and films...
I didn't write both those novels. Can I just clarify that?
But as a writer of novels and films, do you think there are novels that shouldn't become films, not vice versa?
Yeah, do you support that choice by those authors?
I think so. I think it's a good idea because I think you keep some of the mystique. And if somebody has come up with an idea, say The Shadow of the Wind, you know, works best as a novel, and Carlos Ruiz Zafón has actually worked on screenplays before, and that's part of his background... But he wrote that as a novel, and perhaps that's because the story works best as a novel. Maybe that was the best decision because he knew which medium that story would work in.
That's really interesting. Hey, well, there we go. I think there's obviously a huge amount that we could say about this, but I think we're going to have to wrap it up there and get you back another time.
Do email in if you've got any adaptations that you really liked or thought did a good job, or maybe you didn't like at all. I'm always quite surprised. I didn't realise there were books before or things like that.
Yeah, there are loads of them.
Can I ask you a question, which is not a very original question? Actually, we'll twist it slightly. In an adaptation of your life, who would direct the film?
Who would direct it?
Yeah, who would direct it? So not play you, because that's a well-trodden path, but who would direct it? What kind of tone would you go for?
This is a genuinely good question. I think I'd probably have to go with David Fincher. I'm a big fan of his. He's a bit dark, but I'm not...
Is it going to be a criminal life that you're planning to lead?
Well, I just thought it'd be interesting to see him try and make my life dark. I think that'd be quite a challenge for him.
I'm thinking Jim Henson. I'd like to see the way that he rendered my life and experiences as horrifying plasticine faces.
How about you, Russ?
I don't know. Something obvious. Steven Spielberg?
It'd be very warm.
Yeah, heartwarming.
Would you have John Williams do the soundtrack as well?
Probably.
Russ's theme.
No, I would, yeah. In fact, no, that's probably the principal reason of doing it. Get John Williams to give me a theme.
Who would you not want to direct your life?
Probably Terry Gilliam.
Oh, what a nightmare.
You wouldn't even understand it. It's your own life.
So just as a little addendum to that, because I couldn't really shoehorn it in a way that I wanted, I'll tell you really briefly about what Sir Ian McKellen said. Do you like the way I call him Sir Ian, as if I know him? It was just interesting because he specifically talked about adapting Shakespeare both to TV and to the big screen. And he's very theatrical in everything he does, man. He's got amazing poise, that guy. And he said that Shakespeare works really well on the small screen because you can do close-ups and you can engage with the performers because of the way it's been written. When it comes to the big screen, and he did it brilliantly. When you realise this is Magneto talking to you and saying, when it comes to the big screen...
You never know, Charles!
Yes, exactly. Like it's and his whole point was that actually cinema is just a completely different beast. And he obviously knows that, like in a way that not many other even actors do, because he's a proper thespian and he's done TV productions as well as major cinematic productions. He kind of was focusing particularly on the production. So it's very difficult to produce a cinematic production that only has actors in it, and the focus is on the performances and the people and the stage and the theatre and the setting is all in your head. And his whole thing is that that's what Shakespeare wanted, right? Is that he preferred you be sucked into the drama, and it was an ethereal kind of
stage. It was the words, wasn't it?
But not just that, but the drama and the placement of people and their voice, that was telling the story. And he made a joke about, he kept on referring to horses as the major example of this.
Because there's loads of horses in Shakespeare plays, but they're never on stage.
Well, but there's a particular one, I wish I could remember this now, but he particularly referenced one that said that horses are sort of heard, but you don't see them. And that was a stage direction from, I think, Shakespeare at one point. But then in all the cinematic productions, you have to have the horses. And his whole point is that when the author has specifically written that out of the play, in the cinema, you can't get away with not having it because it wouldn't make sense. How can you have a cinematic production that doesn't show the horses?
True.
So true. Yeah, anyway, that's just a slight thought. And if Ian McKellen ever does a talk to you, definitely go and see the guy. Like, he's a powerhouse.
I feel like I want to do a Shakespeare unique feature just on movie adaptions of Shakespeare plays. I feel like that would be worthwhile.
Yeah, possibly. Certainly. I mean, well, you've got Baz Luhrmann in there, haven't you? You've got even like 10 Things I Hate About You.
And you've also got even Joss Whedon. He did one.
Did he?
Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, yeah, that's recent, isn't it? Mm. Yes.
So there's loads of films that have done it. He's the classic storyteller.
Means we get to talk about Kenny Branagh as well. I love that guy.
Yeah, exactly. I think it'd be interesting.
Okay, right. Well, I'm one to think about. All right, there we go. Whew. Well, episode 20, episode 20 is over, Phil. How do you feel?
I want to do it again.
Did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy
the show? Yeah, I had a great time. It was a good chat. Good to hear Russ's thing again.
Yeah, nice to hear from Russ. Well, that's the end of our Russ segment, so we'll grab him on for another one if you guys enjoyed him.
We need to get another mystery guest, I think.
Yeah, we've got a few. I've got a few up my sleeve, actually, Phil, that I've been sort of waiting to surprise you with. That's genuinely the case. You're looking at me like, what are you talking about?
We haven't discussed any other guests.
No, well, why would I when I could surprise you with it?
Oh, brilliant. Mystery.
Yeah. Guys, thanks so much for listening. Sorry that movies were a bit kind of thin on the ground this week. I mean, there were three of them, but they just weren't, you know, all that.
We can only deal with the hand we're dealt, Laurie.
Quite right. Look forward, guys. Next week, we'll do emails and tweets, so keep firing them in. We've already built up quite a few this week, so do let us know what you thought of those films, or particularly let us know your random movie quotes that mean a lot to you and perhaps your friends or family, but no one else really understands. We'd love to hear that.
Yeah, we very much would love to hear those, and it's been great. I've been enjoying reading the ones that were
coming. Yeah. Thanks so much, everyone who sent them in already. It's good fun. We really love that, and hopefully that'll be an awesome segment to put out in, well, maybe next week.
No, not next week, the week after next.
Let's just see how we do in the week.
Yeah, I think well, I want to make a big deal out of this.
Oh yeah. Okay, so that's superbellybros@gmail.com or @superbellybros, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week for emails, tweets, what we've been watching, and maybe or maybe not quotes.
Episode 21.
Anything to add?
Well, next week we'll be able to drink in America.
Wow. I cannot think of anything to respond to that with. Okay, guys, have a great week. We'll speak to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You know that thing that sometimes happens in movies, Phil, when you get like bad movie logic? Have you come across this?
Expand a bit on it.
It's hard to explain. I'm actually thinking I might make a feature out of this, so this is kind of a pre-tease whatever to all that. But I was in the Huntsman film.
Mm.
There's this thing that happens, and I'm sure you'll recognise it. They describe an impossible situation that they have to deal with. You know, the heroes have got to overcome this impossible deal. And then what you get is quite a lengthy description that's hard to understand. And fortunately, the comic relief character sums it up.
Oh, the exposition guy.
You know, but it's not quite exposition. It's more like impossible enemies, impregnable fortress, deadly arrows. I'm in. Do you know what I mean? You can hear it, can't you?
Oh, I hate that.
But the thing is, like, that was it. It's in that film. And I just thought, that doesn't make any sense. But at the same time, it does make sense because everyone in the cinema understands that
language. That's even in Lord of the Rings.
But it just doesn't make any sense at all. It's like, I'm almost certainly going to die. Wicked! Do you know what I mean?
Classic joke.
I don't get it. Like, there's some kind of movie logic that just happens out there that your brain thinks, yeah, that's fine.
Yes. Yeah.
But it makes no sense.
Genre conventions.
What do you think? Can we make a feature of that?
It might make us sad, though, because then we'd find out all these rubbish bits in
movies. Oh, come on. It's just another thing to celebrate.
Hooray.